This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at acura.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, Microsoft challenges Apple's digital download hegemony with an iPod of its own. Then, Jackass number 2 is not the end of the world. And finally, brother, can you spare $300 million? Paramount Pictures gets a cash infusion. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere, it's The Business from NPR. Star Wars director George Lucas made headlines last week with a gift to the school where he honed his craft. $175 million to endow and rebuild USC's School of Cinematic Arts. It was the largest donation in USC history, but it appears he thinks that kind of money is too much to put into a film. In an interview with Variety last week, Lucas surprised many in Hollywood by saying that Lucasfilm is getting out of the movie business. Quote, "We don't want to make movies. We're about to get into television. As far as Lucasfilm is concerned, we've moved away from the feature film thing because it's too expensive and too risky." So, what would the one with whom the force is so strong like Hollywood to do? Well, make lots of smaller films released online. The answer, Lucas says, is, quote, quantity.
Finance you, he can. But cut your budget, you must.
Speaking of wrinkled actors, the 94-year-old Carl Malden got a call from the Academy last week after his Best Supporting Actor Oscar seemed to have turned up on eBay. The Academy wanted to know if it had gone missing. Whereupon Malden looked over at his mantle and stated categorically that it hadn't, which meant that the knockoff statuette being auctioned on eBay was a fake. Or was it? Malden won the Oscar in 1951 for his portrayal of Mitch Mitchell opposite Marlon Brando in A Streetcar Named Desire. Auction item 15004244894 had the right serial number, 626, and the requisite patina. Its owner, a truck driver from Niles, Illinois, claims he found it in a garbage dumpster outside a Chicago office building in 1979. The item has been removed from eBay, and the Academy is investigating the matter. Elsewhere, the Los Angeles Times reported last week on a battle between what it described as California's twin engines, aviation and entertainment. Airlines at Los Angeles International Airport are apparently protesting a request by 20th Century Fox to close portions of nearby freeways this fall to film scenes for the latest Bruce Willis Die Hard movie, Live Free or Die Hard. It seems the airlines are concerned about the freeway closures making people late for their flights and the scare fake explosions might cause security-sensitive passengers. We think the real reason is that they don't want their planes ending up in the movie, which we can safely predict will be a piece of We end with other excrement-related news. Los Angeles County officials intend to employ DNA testing to determine exactly which Hollywood moguls are letting their sewage foul the Malibu coastline. The AP reported last week that health officials suspect Malibu homeowners' leaky septic tanks are allowing what gets flushed down the toilet to flow down the hills and into the Pacific Ocean. To identify the offenders, authorities intend to use genetic testing and, if necessary, get warrants to inspect the septic tanks, including those of Hollywood celebrities. This is going to get messy, predicts Mark Pestrella, the public works official assigned to the project. Oh, Mark, you have no idea how messy. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later on the show, a public radio producer confesses,
"Yeah, I saw Jackass number 2. I loved it, and I don't care who knows it."
But next, what do Yep, Bean, Zen, and Sansa all have in common? What do Yep, Bean, Zen, and Sansa all have in common? They're the digital music players made by Samsung, Sony, Creative, and SanDisk that are fighting for some of the iPod's market share. But these players, combined with a long list of others, will account for only about 25% of the players purchased this year. Now, Microsoft has announced that it's coming out with its player just in time for Christmas. Generically named Zune, Microsoft says they're committed to taking a bite out of Apple's market share with the player and a new music subscription service. Ben Fritz is technology reporter for Variety, and Jeff Leeds is a music business writer for the New York Times. Ben, how did Apple and iPod capture such a huge share of the digital download market?
People buy music from iTunes because they have an iPod, and they work together so seamlessly, and in fact, the iPod doesn't work with any other digital music service. So it's because the iPod is the best designed, coolest system out, player out there.
Well, those are two different things. I don't want to touch on both of them in a second. But Jeff Leeds, do you buy that? Was it that?
I think that's a big part of the answer, and I think the other part is the cool factor. And Apple put a lot of money and a lot of thinking into, you know, how to make their service and their player the coolest one. And I think, you know, those iconic sort of black and white iPod and iTunes ads that we've come to. Were a smart strategy, and Apple put a lot of money behind their marketing, which is something that really not a lot of other companies had done to that point.
Mm-hmm. What about the content relationships that Apple has is unique to Apple?
You know, it's been an interesting evolution because at the beginning, when the iTunes service was unveiled in 2003, the music business was in very serious trouble, and it had been a couple of years since Napster had introduced file sharing, free unauthorized file sharing to the masses, and
also known as stealing,
also known as copyright infringement, and the sales were tanking, and the industry had been sort of casting about for several years by this point without any real accomplishments in terms of moving into the digital realm and selling music online legally, and. So when Jobs introduced this simple, seamless, very easy to understand service, they just hailed him as a genius and were very quick to line up behind him. And you know, if you think about it, it's been a very short time, really. As early as 2005, you know, the Apple had achieved such dominance in the field that they were able to say, you know, start to dictate terms in a way that I think the labels didn't really expect at the outset. And so. You know, one of the big issues was that some of the labels wanted to start moving away from Apple's policy of uniform pricing for individual singles. They cost 99 cents a piece on iTunes, and not all the labels were happy with that. They wanted more variation, and mm-hmm. Jobs was not willing to budge on that issue. And the relationship really has grown much more tense, and Jobs ultimately prevailed when those deals were renegotiated and kept the pricing as it is. But I think the relationship is now one where the labels view Apple as, as a player that can sometimes, you know, dictate to them.
Ben Fritz, what will competitors have to do to break that stranglehold? Can they even?
Well, the most important thing they have to do, again, is come up with a sort of seamless system where the player works easily with the service, and the player is just as cool, if not cooler, than the iPod, which is a very high standard. That's what Microsoft's trying to do with their new Zune, which is a player and a digital music store that launches, I think, next month. And Rhapsody, which is a service that's been out there for a while. They had been using Microsoft software, which has been not worked out well for them. So they're working with another company to make their own player to work with their subscription service. So they really have to have a complete end-to-end system. That is just as user-friendly as iPod and iTunes and offers some advantage, some way to stand out. So it's a very tall order.
Well, let's talk about the Xbox, which is really the only major hardware success that Microsoft can tout. And, you know, success sort of in quotes, we sort of should ask the question, you know, with this thing costing the company $10 billion and getting them only a quarter of the gaming market, you know, how many more successes can Microsoft really afford? I mean, what is Microsoft's strategy here? How are they going to try and make a run at this?
Well, their strategy is the same as the Xbox on a smaller scale. They expect to lose, I'd say, hundreds of millions of dollars in the first few years. But if they can establish their dominance, not only will they eventually make money, as they're starting to do on Xbox soon, but they'll bring people into the Microsoft Windows family, the ecosystem, as they like to call it, which is, you know, Microsoft is essentially a software company, so they don't mind losing money on the hardware if they bring you into the family. And that's what they're going to do with Zune, and they're going to come out of the gate this holiday season, and if they don't do well, I mean, that sucks, but that's okay. They'll spend more money and fix their mistakes and keep going. And they're in a position where they can afford to do that, whereas a lot of their smaller competitors cannot.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Leeds, how is this different from any number of other cheapy players out there?
Well, I think there'll be a couple differences. One clear one is going to be the amount of money that the Microsoft puts behind it, and the amount of resources that go into their marketing and advertising campaign, which, you know, shouldn't be underestimated. And I think the other interesting bet they've made is one that has to do with sort of consumer behavior that I think no one else has really tried yet, which is this concept of being able to DJ or share music with other people that have a Zune player. Microsoft's making, I think, an interesting bet, depending on how much the technology will allow, that consumers are really going to gravitate to the experience of wanting to kind of show off to each other and share with each other using their player. And I think it'll be interesting to watch whether that one feature is enough to really sort of bring people into the Zune experience. I think some people are skeptical about that, but that to me is one of the most distinctive things about it.
So are they making a technological bet, or are they making a sort of cool factor bet?
I guess it's a combination of both. I mean, I think it's technologically more advanced, right? The wireless capability is something that iPod does not have, and so they've had to kind of innovate technologically to get there. But it also is kind of a bet on psychology and consumer behavior. The good news for them, I suppose, is that the music market has evolved in this way that not even Apple has caught up yet.
Mm-hmm. Ben Fritz, let's now begin to attack maliciously this new device, which we've not yet seen and know very little about. That shouldn't stop us from being petty and catty.
Oh, no.
What are some of the cons that right off the bat we know are going to be a problem for the Zune, which is, in addition to being a word that means nothing?
Look, there's numerous. First of all, the name Microsoft sort of carries the cachet of uncool with it, wherever it goes.
A cultural pocket protector, if there ever was one.
Absolutely. So, which is why I think they're going to try to use the word Zune and downplay the word Microsoft as much as possible, just as you don't see the word Microsoft very much in Xbox marketing.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem is people who are familiar with the digital music market and who will be writing about it and reviewing it know that Microsoft actually has been in the music market for several years with a system called Plays for Sure, which people in the industry call Plays for something else that starts with an S, and it works really poorly, and people have had bad experiences with it, and it's gonna be brought up by a lot of people who are reviewing the Zune and talking about it. And so Microsoft has a huge hurdle to overcome just in getting past that. And then on top of that, they're coming out and very blatantly, almost honestly, trying in many ways to copy Apple, you know. And if they don't match everything Apple's doing in terms of coolness and quality in any way at all, they're going to be ripped apart for it, because we all see the iPod and the iTunes and we know how it works, and it's a very high standard to match.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Leeds, what about the idea that, and I saw this in a lot of the reportage when Microsoft first announced its pricing plan, the idea that Microsoft is actually competing with itself through its essentially its Windows Mobile platform, that this device might actually compete against its own products and against its own partners, that it might injure its own partners. Talk a little bit about that.
Right. I think that part of the problem is going to be that they're not going to have much support from a lot of other players in the digital music space, people that have created various services and devices and so forth, because what they're doing by introducing the Zune hardware and software is abandoning this Plays for Sure system. And so everyone that's been sort of betting on that and building their systems to sort of be compatible with that and their devices and so forth, there's a perception in that community that Microsoft is really abandoning them and walking away from them and saying, well, you know, that really didn't work. Sorry, we're going to work on our own system now and really support that more than anything else. So they are putting themselves in a position where they're going to be competing against people that had been their partners, and I don't think that's going to engender a great deal of cooperation and love from that community.
So do they stand a chance is the obvious question. Can Microsoft make a dent in this, or anybody for that matter, at this point in the market? Are they not RC Cola?
No, not quite, only because as big as it is, the digital music market still has plenty of growth left to do. I don't know the stats offhand, but a lot of people still haven't gotten their iPod. And at this point, if Microsoft or anybody else can just get a decent fraction of that growth, then, you know, that's a decent business to be in. And then they have to use that to start building and really, really make a dent in Apple. So it's tough, but there are still a lot of people out there who are left to enter this market. And so there at least is potential.
Jeff Leeds, what does Microsoft have to do first and foremost to get any traction at all on this?
I think the first thing they have to do is try to find a way to crack the iPod's sort of aura of cool. And I think that that means they're going to have to come up with unique content, music or other sort of content that people just have to have that is only available on the Zune or through the Zune service. And I think it's going to have to be in their marketing and advertising. It's going to have to be really creative, and it's really going to have to do something that makes the iPod seem like yesterday's news.
Ben Fritz is technology reporter for Variety and Daily Variety. Ben, thanks for being on The Business.
My pleasure.
Jeff Leeds is music correspondent for The New York Times. Jeff, thanks for being on The Business.
You bet.
Teens account for the vast majority of the digital music player market. In fact, the entire entertainment industry has become obsessed with keeping the young folks spending their allowances on music, TV, games, and other diversions aimed directly at them. To wit, Jackass Number 2. The in-theater version of the popular MTV show, wherein Johnny Knoxville and his cohorts perform death and taste-defying pranks. Jackass Number 2 opened bigger than any R-rated movie so far this year, and many see this success as a sign of the coming apocalypse. But to the Four Horsemen, the business producer Matt Holtzman can only say, giddy up.
Yeah, I saw Jackass Number 2. I loved it, and I don't care who knows it. Let's just not go into why I, a card-carrying member of the media elite, would do such a thing. Why I would commit an evening and $14 plus $2 parking to see grown men put beer up their butts and slam each other's faces with pneumatic boxing gloves and wrestle with giant anacondas. Call it an anthropological mission to observe the rituals of a curious tribe. But like Jane Goodall getting too darn friendly with those monkeys, in the end, I went native. I was laughing and screaming and cringing at the top of my lungs with the rest of the great unwashed. And it felt great. In fact, the whole evening was a surprise. First, there were girls in the theater. Not just girls who'd been dragged there by their boyfriends, but girls who would come by themselves. And even the guys that were there surprised me. I did not see one knuckle drag or one drop of drool on the theater's carpet. Now, I'm not going to insult you by saying Jackass Number 2 is a great film. In fact, aside from the fact that it's projected in a theater, it isn't a film at all, but a 95-minute TV show. But I do want to say this. For its reported budget of $11 million, it provided more entertainment than Independence Day, Pearl Harbor, The Hulk, and Matrix Revolutions combined. And that's almost $1 billion worth of fatuous filmmaking right there. I'm sorry, but I'll take a midget being smothered by a naked fat woman over hackneyed dialogue punctuated by countless explosions any old day. And yes, I said midget, and I said fat. In the world of Jackass, we are relieved of the burden of political correctness. And that is one more point for Jackass. Okay, Jackass isn't a film, but that's one of the reasons it works. They didn't try to shove the eight Jackassians and their shenanigans into a pathetic movie plot. And they didn't change what made it great on TV like they did when they set Wild Wild West in the future, when they made Starsky and Hutch a comedy, or well, I don't know what the hell they did to McHale's Navy. Jackass the movie is Jackass the TV show, with more money to blow stuff up and a bigger screen and louder speakers to increase the cringe factor. Listen, my snooty public radio friends, lighten up. Jackass is not the end of the world. And if you're so concerned that it's the end of great filmmaking, I have to ask you a question. Where were you when All the King's Men opened a couple of weekends ago? I'll tell you where you were. At home, drinking a glass of Pinot Grigio and watching Curb Your Enthusiasm on HBO. Shame on you. You have created a world where teens rule the movie theater. Call it what you will. A movie. A TV show. Pure fun or pure evil. But be prepared, because Jackass is more than any of that. It's a paradigm for future box office success. Hey, Ashton Kutcher, can you say Punked the movie?
Matt Holtzman is the producer of The Business. Coming up after a short break, investment banks, co-financing, Monte Carlo analysis. It's all too exciting for words. You're listening to The Business from NPR. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business. You might think that most of Hollywood's business is conducted over grilled vegetable salads at the Ivy. But more and more, the real business of show is being handled by anonymous money mavens in high-rises in New York, London, and Frankfurt. Over the past decade, there's been more and more complicated financing for movie production. And it's not just rich people with more money than sense or hedge fund managers high on the adrenaline of a deal, but banks and other normally conservative financial institutions. Take, for instance, last week's announcement by the International Investment Bank of Dresdner Kleinwort. This venerable institution has arranged for $300 million in funding for at least 30 of Paramount's upcoming pictures. But why would buttoned-up bankers risk their clients' money in the seemingly nonsensical world of show business? Laura Fazio was Dresdner Kleinwort's point person on the Paramount deal. Laura, thanks for being on The Business.
Yep, thank you very much for having me.
Tell us sort of how the movie business got into this business of sort of getting into bed with people who have lots of money, because this is sort of, in a sense, fairly new, although not that new.
Actually, it's not that new. There's always been interested single-party investors, where people, high-net-worth individuals, had an interest in financing usually a single picture.
Right.
And that has changed. This is the types of transactions we do are very different from those types of transactions. That was generally somebody wants to be in the movie business. He has a lot of money. He wants to hang out with the stars, and so he talks to someone about a script and invests. Where this has moved from is really it is quite dry, I have to tell you. It's really based on Monte Carlo analysis and on statistical analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I think two things really drove the business to where it is now, which is people are looking for more attractive returns. You know, the traditional means are fewer and fewer. And then on the other side of the shop is the studios are looking. Studio production budgets continue to rise with all of the special effects. So the cost to make a movie is ever higher. They're seeking to reduce the risk of that single picture. And it was the first securitization transaction took place in like 1997 with the News Corp transaction, and that used this Monte Carlo simulation theory, and
in simple English, what is the Monte Carlo? One imagines Bond in a tuxedo ordering a martini while banking.
In plain English, if you have 20 to 25 films, we know based on all of our data, and we have data from all the studios for over the past 10, 20 years, we know that about a third of them are going to do okay, a third are going to do less than okay, and a third are going to do much better. And the expectation is that the third that do better are going to offset the third that more than offset the third that don't do so well.
Mm-hmm.
And we have our models support that. And that's
right.
Really what has driven the investor interest in this space. And likewise, as the budgets have increased and the studios have said, you know, historically the studios would either go out and find, there's a variety of means. There was there was German and UK tax shelters, which gave them, which would reduce their negative cost or their production cost. Or you would find a single investor who might want to come in and invest in one, two, or three films. Or they would go to other studios. I think a good example, we look at like Titanic. Titanic was made by News Corp, and when the budgets it was made by Fox. When the budget got too high, they went out and sought a partner. They ultimately sold the domestic rights of that film to Paramount. It was one of the best trades Paramount ever did, actually, because as we know, Titanic was a global blockbuster, and Paramount had a fixed price, which
$75 million, and they got the biggest movie of all time.
Exactly.
So, but here's the glaring question: is if these movies are such slam dunks, why give them away at all? I mean, there seems to be a fair amount of risk here, especially since, as my mutual fund companies are always fond of telling me, past performance is no indication of future gains. So, I mean, we're in sort of a different place now for movies, and it's almost not even germane to compare the movies that get made today with the movies that get made even 10 or 15 years ago, because the budgets are just, you know, cuckoo.
The budgets are. Well, because they have finite levels of capital. They're seeking to diversify their risk because they are they you know, investors increasingly look at their share price, look at how much capital they're putting into that particular business, and they're trying to protect their downside. I had one client I did a transaction for late last year, and the client said, oh gosh, what am I going to do when every single one of these movies is a winner, and I've sold off X percent of the portfolio. And it's interesting because in that case, actually, almost every movie has done fabulously, and the slate has done wonderfully. But the studio recognizes, you know, it could just have easily been a Poseidon.
Yeah, instead of a Titanic. Sure.
Instead of a Titanic. So, you know, they're willing. You know, they are risk. There are risk managers in those studios and in those diversified media corporates which own those studios, and they are and they want to manage the risk.
I want to ask you about sort of the pros and cons of putting money into just one basket. Now, admittedly, we're talking about $300 million here over 30 films, which is actually kind of a small investment per film, if in fact that's mm-hmm. how it's being broken up. Is it being just, you know, sort of individually sliced up, you know, equally? Is that fair to say?
Not exactly equally, but more or less equally. There's a rough kind of a band percentage that will go into each film.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no cherry picking. The investors are aligned with the studio's interests so that every single picture that the studio does, the investor has an investment in. So the studio can't say, hey, I like this deal. You know, I like Jackass, but I don't like, you know, another one, you know.
Mm-hmm. So right, Nacho Libre or whatever.
Yeah, Nacho Libre did good, though.
Yeah, it did. Well, let me ask you, I mean, let's talk about why this particular basket, without asking you to speculate on, you know, who's going to have a job at Paramount, who's not. But there's been an immense amount of change and a lot of headlines coming out mm-hmm. of Paramount. Obviously, this deal was in the works for quite a while before any of this stuff hit the fan, so to speak. But Tom Freston is gone. Brad Gray has his future sort of a little bit cloudy there. Talk a little bit about the pros and cons of putting money into one basket, and a little bit about why you chose this basket.
Okay, I think
the Paramount basket.
The Paramount basket. Well, unlike some other transactions where there's a blind pool, I think on the Disney transaction, the Magic Kingdom deal, it's actually you don't know what films necessarily you're going to invest in. You'll just be investing in whatever films that Disney goes in. We know all of these films. We have an understanding what demographic, what, and we have models, and we have a consultant who has comps that, you know, I can look and I have a good idea of how many people are going to be invested or interested in this genre of a film. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of why. I mean, I have a level of comfort with how Brad runs his business, how he runs the studio, and the types of films they're planning to make and market.
For the longest time, back when there were, you know, at the beginning of this whole investing in Hollywood business, I'm thinking of all these mm-hmm. all these dentists who wanted to have, you know, dinner with Goldie Hawn or something like that. Now that you're lining up all this money over all these movies, have you yourself now turned into one of these dentists? Are you going to the dinners now with George Clooney or with Steven Spielberg? Are you at the Ivy now? Are you a player?
Am I a player? I wish. No, we don't do any of that. We don't get executive producer credit.
Well, you should probably revisit that contract. Laura Fazio is managing director at Dresdner Klein Wart. The bank just recently arranged $300 million of financing for Paramount Pictures. Laura, thanks for being on The Business.
Yep, thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com, keyword The Business. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.